We have three cases to be argued this morning. The first of these is number 12-1649, Sovereign Software v. Victoria's Secret. Mr. Joseph.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. This is an unusual appeal because after we filed the appeal, there have been two dispositive legal developments. This Court's decision in Newegg and also the recent 101 jurisprudence. The Court need look no farther than Newegg, however, a decision of this Court just last year holding that the same patent claims, or materially identical ones, are invalid. That decision has preclusive effect. In fact, we are aware of no case since the Supreme Court's Blonder-Tongue decision in which a patent has been held to be invalid, but the courts have allowed the patentee to go on asserting it anyway. We are also aware of no decision of any federal court of appeals on any issue that has been held to lack preclusive effect on the ground that a federal court of appeals deprived the litigant of a full or fair hearing. Their position that this court did that last year is absurd, especially considering that they got a more full hearing than the vast majority of appellate litigants get, given that this court granted a limited rehearing for the very purpose of assuring that it had fairly considered the issues.
If I recall correctly, the case came before this court on a new trial issue. It didn't come on a JMAL issue, but that in making the new trial argument, there was an argument that as a matter of law, the jury had to find obviousness. Is that a fair statement of what happened?
Yeah, that was disputed in Newegg itself, but we'll, for present purposes, we're certainly willing to assume that the relief that had been squarely requested there was a new trial, but there's no question their underlying argument also showed that they were entitled to JMAL. The more important point, though, is that this is a merits issue that's not subject to reopening, because there should be no question that a court of appeals, by statute, has the right to grant whatever relief it considers appropriate, whether or not it was requested by a party. Those cases are in pages 6 to 7 of our reply brief.
Can I ask just a factual question? I think I know the answer to this about Newegg. In that case, the district judge granted judgment of non-obviousness to the other side, and it was at the close of all the evidence, right? So the other side did have a full opportunity to present any evidence on the obviousness question, or was it before they had to put on their case?
There's no question. I believe there's no dispute whatsoever.
Yeah,
I believe there's no dispute that the plaintiffs put in all of the evidence in the record that they possibly wanted to in the district court. I don't believe they've ever argued that they were denied a full or fair hearing in the district court. And then, of course, the district court record is then the record on appeal. I believe their argument is limited to the notion that in this court, they thought they were defending against one form of relief, not another, and therefore they say that they would have handled it differently in the panel stage briefing.
Suppose there had been an argument, which I think there has not been, that in a new trial they would have put in additional evidence on an issue, for example, motivation to combine, that they would have had somebody come in and testify that the prior art taught away, which they hadn't done before. Would that make a difference?
No, for two reasons. First, again, we're into the merits here, which is what preclusion prevents reconsideration of. Because whether this court properly exercised its discretion to grant a particular form of relief in that case, in the facts and circumstances of that case, is a merits determination to be made in that case. But second, they knew on appeal they were defending against a determination that those patents were non-obvious as a matter of law. So they knew they had to.
I'm not sure that's responsive to my question. And I understand what you're saying, that they are arguing that they would have made a stronger argument on appeal, or they would have cared more, or something like that. Right. But if instead they were arguing, well, if we'd had a new trial, we would have put in different evidence, that seems to me to be potentially a different case. I understand that appears not to be this case, but that would be a different case, wouldn't it?
I agree with you that they've never identified any evidence that they would have done differently the first time around, so it's clearly not this case. But also, I don't understand in the context of that case, I mean, they knew that they had to establish obviousness as a matter of law, both in the trial court and in this court. So that's why I don't know that it would matter. Their other argument, though, and also, I mean, their other argument then is that they claim
this is why I asked the question before. Knowing that you have to establish obviousness as a matter of law isn't the same as knowing that It's arguing that you had a triable case of obviousness, and that couldn't be taken away from you.
Except that if you're going to defend judgment as a matter of law, it's a pretty high standard. But even if that's all right, the point is that this court has been, I mean, this court resolved that. I don't believe they argued that they failed to do anything in the district court. I don't know how they could argue they haven't. But then on appeal in this court, I mean, this court, for example, granted rehearing for the express purpose of ensuring it fairly considered all the issues against the same set of arguments. And on rehearing, they argued the same points they're arguing now, albeit in the context of different patent claims.
Are you arguing that the denial of rehearing is itself preclusive of the fairness, full and fair opportunity issue, or just that since they have the opportunity, we can now determine that they had a full and fair opportunity?
I think they had a full and fair hearing before rehearing, but I think it's a no-brainer that when this court grants limited rehearing and then determines on rehearing, grant, not denied, that Sovereign devotes much of its supplemental briefing to re-argument of issues resolved in the court's prior opinion, especially in terms of product identifier and shopping cart database, the same issues they're re-arguing here, we discern no basis for departing from the court's analysis in its prior opinion, and this court then quoted its earlier determinations on the merits. So they got an actual rehearing on the same points. If the court has no further questions for me, I'll turn it over to counsel for Victoria's Secret.
Thank you. Mr. Rowe, is that
yes,
how you pronounce it?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm here on behalf of Victoria's Secret. We believe that the collateral estoppel issues are case dispositive and that this court really need look no further than those issues. But we did want to take a few moments to point out that there are two additional issues that we think provide independent and clear-cut bases for granting judgment in favor of the appellants in this case. The first is that the claims are directed to unpatentable subject matter under Section 101. And
can I ask you about that, the waiver question? I don't think you cited a case for a proposition that I think you need. I don't know whether you have such a case. And that is, you did not make a 50B motion for judgment under 101. You made a 50A. They made a 50A the other way. The court granted the other side. And although I guess the question is there a case for the proposition that in that circumstance where the issue did not in fact go to the jury, you did not have to renew the motion under 50B?
Well, I think the issue is, I mean, clearly the court, as you mentioned, granted J-Mall in favor of the plaintiff on the issue. There was no dispute between the parties that it was an issue of law. There were no facts for the jury to decide, and the judge made a ruling that it was granting judgment in favor of the plaintiff.
Right. I was trying to ask a very specific question.
And I understand.
I think I understand how to think about the issue. Do you have a case?
I do not have a case that specifically says in a context where I don't think I have seen a case in the context where the court has granted J-Mall for one party when there were cross motions for J-Mall and the party didn't raise it in a 50B context. And so we cited the E-Plus case that says that, you know, you kind of don't have to raise things that are obviously denied, and here the judge had granted the J-Mall, but I do not have a case that says if the court has granted J-Mall against you, do you have to renew it in a 50B context to say, judge, do you want to reconsider granting J-Mall on the other side?
Well, why don't you just rely on the language of the rule? I mean, the language of the rule seems to be pretty clear, doesn't it? It says if the district court does not grant J-Mall, the court is considered to have submitted the action to the jury. That's why you have to renew it, because the rule says that if he doesn't grant it, it's submitted to the jury. Obviously, if he does grant it, it's not submitted to the jury, and there's no reason to make a second motion.
That's correct. So turning to the substance of the 101 issue, I think it was clear at the time that we filed the briefs that these claims are directed to unpatentable subject matter, but certainly the law since then with Alice and this court's subsequent application of the Alice case in, for example, BuySafe versus Google, makes clear that these are directed to unpatentable subject matter. The first prong under the Alice test is to look to see whether they're directed to abstract ideas, and then the second prong you look to see whether there's an inventive concept. Here, they're clearly drawn to basic shopping concepts. that are abstract ideas. For the shopping cart claims, they're directed to the abstract idea of shopping for multiple items and purchasing them in a single transaction, something that's been going on in brick-and-mortar stores and through catalog sales and things for years. And on the hypertext statement...
Why is that abstract? It's well known and common, but it doesn't seem to me to be abstract in the sense that that word is normally used.
Well, I think if you look, for example, at the BuySafe case, which talked about the fact that claims directed to the formation and manipulation of economic relations and contractual relations between parties have consistently been found to be directed to abstract ideas. So you have Alice directed to third party to mitigate settlement risk. You have Bilski hedging financial risk.
Well, sure, I understand that, but I mean, if you're talking about shopping in the terms of, you know, going to the store, paying through a cash register, or maybe a credit card machine or thing, some parts of that at least don't seem abstract. The notion of exchanging money is, of course, abstract, but a shopping cart, a cash register, credit card machine, those aren't abstract devices.
I mean, the idea of a shopping, I mean, it's no more than I want to buy multiple items and I want to pay for them at once. That's basically what the claims are directed to. And then you look at, you know, in terms of an inventive concept, what they say in their brief is that they invented it because, on page 46, inventing a system that allowed multitudes of customers to conduct commerce simultaneously over a stateless network, such as the Internet. Of course, in Newegg, this court has already found that those claims are not inventive. But you look, that's not in the claims at all. The claims require at least one buyer computer and one server computer. So if you have one-to-one relationship, you know, what they're claiming is the inventive concept is not embodied in the claims at all. And the second issue is Centillion, but my time's up. But I think that's the other dispositive issue that on which this court can grant judgment in our favor.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Lampkin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Jeff Lampkin for Sovereign Software. I want to start out by
answering... Am I correct that you're not arguing that you would have put in additional evidence at a new trial?
Well, actually, in this case, in the Yvonne case itself, we put in much more expansive evidence than we did in the prior trial on Newegg.
I never saw an argument in your brief.
That's not the full opportunity we thought was absent here. We're not arguing that. But in fact, that is the case, Judge Dyke. I wanted to answer Judge Toronto's question to start out, which is there a case saying that you're excused from filing a 50B motion because the judge ruled against you on Rule 50A? And the answer is no, because the Supreme Court held precisely the opposite in a case called Globe Liquor versus San Ramon. It's 332 U.S. 571. It is reaffirmed and explained in the Supreme Court's decision in Unitherm.
What about the language of the rule?
Well, the language of the rule, the Supreme Court has flatly held, and I could go back and look at the language of the rule for you right now, the Supreme Court has flatly held that you are not excused from filing a
rule. The rule says if the motion, if JMAL's not granted.
I think that's properly read.
How could it be submitted to the jury if the motion was granted?
Right, but it says if your motion for JMAL is not granted.
I understand that, but doesn't the theory of it suggest that if the motion is granted, it's not submitted to the jury?
It's not submitted to the jury, but your burden is...
So why do you have to make another motion if it's not submitted to the jury?
For one thing, because the rule says so, and the second is the Supreme Court has said so. But even
where does the rule say so?
The reason says that if your motion is not granted...
Right, but the rule, as you know, is its language does not go as far as Unitherm does. It doesn't say you have to do this. It says you do something under A, and then if it goes to the jury, you do something under B. It doesn't actually... really address what doesn't even seem terribly logical, which is that you would have to renew a motion on an issue that is already dead.
Well, because it's a different issue. When the judge granted Rule 50A to the other side, the judge has decided that you can't win as a matter of law. If you not only think that you are entitled to get to the jury, but you should have won as a matter of law, that's a separate question. That's why you have to have a 50B motion, and the judge, who saw the trial, who heard the evidence, who understands what's credible and not.
Does it make any difference? I know there are a number of cases in the courts of appeals that say you don't have to renew 50A if it's a question of law, which we have certainly treated the 101 issue as being. Why wouldn't that at least take it out of what might be an otherwise applicable 50B requirement?
I think the courts have treated it, when they have used the phrase, a pure issue of law. And I think Section 101 has factual underpinnings. For example, you have to know what was purely conventional at the time. And when you're working in a fast-moving technology area like the Internet in the 1994 timeframe, remember, this is the Internet in its infancy, what is purely conventional is a factual issue you're going to have to get into. So that exception wouldn't be applicable, even if there were an exception in Rule 50 for pure issues of law. And on that, we actually think the First Circuit has it right, which is Rule 50 doesn't have a pure issue of law exception. Courts aren't required to make squirrely distinctions between whether something is purely legal or has factual underpinnings. The basic rule is, if this is an issue that is a jury issue, and you think the jury should only have been able to come out your way, you at the very least are required to make your motion under Rules 50A and 50B. But turning back, I think I wanted to make a point under Rule 50A and start there, which is that Unitherm and this Court's decision in Biodex are clear that a party's failure to make a Rule 50 motion deprives the Court of power to grant judgment on the issue. That forecloses this Court's ruling on the issue of obviousness in this case, but it also forecloses the Court from ruling on obviousness through collateral estoppel, because collateral estoppel is issue preclusion. You only get preclusion on an issue that's still in the case. When defendants failed to make a Rule 50A motion or a Rule 50B motion, obviousness ceased to be in this case.
Wait a second. What case suggests that where the collateral estoppel ground arises on appeal that we shouldn't consider it? I thought Mendenhall was in point and that we did consider it in Mendenhall.
Mendenhall does not mention Rule 50 or address Rule 50. And if it's one thing about cases like that where they don't actually mention issue, is they cannot be taken as a holding on
point. So it's in point, except they didn't consider this argument.
Well, they didn't consider this argument. And in Mendenhall, in fact...
But it's otherwise in point.
Right? Well, in Mendenhall, there was no Rule 50 issue because one of the trials was a bench trial, and the other trial there was a stipulation where it didn't go to the jury.
But otherwise, it's in point, right?
Pardon?
Apart from that, it's in point.
Well, it's in point in the sense that you can raise issue preclusion on appeal if you've preserved the issue properly. But it doesn't address what happens when you have not preserved the issue on which you seek preclusion.
On the full and fair opportunity argument, you're basically arguing, as I understand it, that you would have argued harder on the first appeal if you'd known that you were facing the possibility of JMAL, right?
Yeah. The answer isn't harder. The answer is completely differently. The argument Well, the argument we were confronted with was that there were material issues of fact, disputed materials issues of fact, that should have gone to the jury. So when you confront that, you go to the undisputed issues, and you say, in view of these undisputed issues only, stay away from the disputed
what
issues.
What would you have argued differently?
Well, for starters, we would have talked about the fact that their expert was completely destroyed on credibility, that this was not something that Newegg could have taken as a given. And in fact, Newegg, if you read the decision, it walks through and says, defendant's expert, defendant's expert, defendant's expert. That expert had no credibility whatsoever. So that's one thing we would have pointed out. But that is why it's completely different, is that when you go, you don't have any incentive to point to
the
disputed issues.
What else besides arguing about the expert?
Well, the second thing we would have done is we actually would have backed up and steeped the court in the technology of 1994 and very clearly explained all the differences, disputed or undisputed, between CompuServe, the prior art on which the court relied, and our invention. For example, and this is something I don't think the court really got, is that CompuServe operated as a dumb terminal through a dedicated line. It was dedicated to making it work because it took your computer and it took away its computing functionality. And it made it basically a dumb terminal that operated the server remotely. So you were just a dumb screen. So when you pressed O, that was not product identifying information that identified the product. It was just an order command. And if you sort of plugged it into another computer, it would have no idea what you were doing.
Okay, what else would you have argued that you didn't? What else would you have argued that you say you didn't?
I could go through a whole number of lists. We could talk about the fact that the CompuServe, we would have gone through the specification, for example, if we had known this was at issue. And this is actually quite key because Did
you say that in your brief?
We didn't point to the specification, but I should point to it.
Confine yourself to the things that you argued in your brief. What is it that you're saying that you would have argued differently?
Well, Judge Dyke, those are the basic issues that we have in our brief, that the product identifier is, because the specification says the product identifier represents the product, O does not represent the product, I believe we would have won if we had the opportunity. But the point for issue preclusion is not, are we correct, or was that correct? The whole question is, was there an opportunity? Was there a full and fair opportunity? And when you're arguing that there was no material issue of fact, you don't go to the disputed issues. And you don't go to them and say, well, in light of all these disputed issues, a jury could come out our way. Because that's completely counterproductive. When you start pointing to the disputed issues, you start making it look like, indeed, there should have been a new trial because there's a whole bunch of disputed issues. It would have been an entirely different case. We would have taken the court back to 1994. We would have pointed out in 1994, browsers were almost a novelty. Search engines were out there. Were barely out there. This was an entirely different era. Instead, we devoted 6 pages to this issue. That's not the type of thing you do when you're fighting for the life of your patent, as opposed to merely addressing a new trial issue. Turning briefly, I know the court didn't get to use, but if the court would like me to turn to use, we believe that this case is completely different from Centillion because defendants use each and every element of the claim system. There's no dispute they use the shopping cart database. They use it to receive messages from the buyer's computer. They don't dispute that they use the shopping cart computer, which receives the messages and programs the shopping cart database in response. They really shouldn't be able to dispute that they use the buyer computer.
Was Centillion different in the respect that you just articulated? Namely, was it not the case there that the defendants used each element?
The court found that the final element in Centillion was the one that the defendant Quest did not use.
Listed element.
And the final listed element was described as the personal computer data processing means. So basically the data processing on the buyer's computer. And there was a reason for that. Quest didn't install the software processing material on the data on the user's computer. The buyer did. Quest didn't run it. The buyer did. And Quest didn't get the result. Only the buyer did. So as a result, the customer, I should say the customer and the buyer, there was nothing for sale there. But as a result, Quest was entirely indifferent as to what happened on that computer with respect to the data processing means. This case is quite the opposite, because in this case, defendants program the buyer's computer so that it will send particular messages in response to the user's command. And those messages include the payment message, for example, which has specific types of data. And then that they program the computer to send that data to their computers, which their computers then use to operate the shopping cart. And then they send back messages and programming to cause the computer to display particular items. So this is a situation in which defendants are very much using the buyer's program or the buyer's computer. And there's a reason for that. This is a network-based sales system. Defendants use that sales system to make their sales. Now, conversely, the buyer may also use the system in order to make purchases. But there's no rule that says you can only have one user of a system. It happens all the time.
I'm focused for 1 second on claim 34 of the 314. This is not the last element, but is it the first element? The at least one buyer computer. Why isn't that the same as what you just described as the last element in the Centillion claim?
Right. The difference is that in Centillion, right, they had a buyer computer and they had data processing means. And the question was, who uses the data processing means? Does Quest use the data processing means? And Quest, by the time of the data processing means, was completely hands-off. They didn't touch the computer. They didn't get the results. They didn't do anything at all. In our case, the buyer computer is an integral part of the transaction. Defendants program the computer to send information to them, and then they use the information that the computer has provided. And so even that little transaction where you program a buyer's computer to send you information is a use of the buyer's computer. And I'd point this court to the DECA case. And in DECA, one of the questions was, there's a radio tower, and the question was, when you have a receiver and you utilize signals from the radio tower to figure out where your location is, and that was the patented invention there, was finding out where you are using a series of radio towers, do you use the radio tower? And this court held, yes, when you receive signals from the radio tower, you use the radio tower. When we receive information from the buyer computer, when defendants receive information from the buyer computer, information they program the buyer computer to provide, they use the buyer computer.
Wouldn't that equally have been true in Centillion put
no.
that way?
No, in Centillion, in fact, that last data processing step, it started and stopped completely at the buyer's computer. Nothing went back to Quest. And that's why Quest was off the hook. Quest did not use, did not benefit from, it did not receive any data involved in the data processing step. That all happened on the PC. No communication of that result back to Quest, no use of the result to Quest. Quest was utterly indifferent to it. It did not receive that signal. Completely different in that respect. If Quest had taken the data processed and it had been sent back to them, and Quest had used it for some purpose, I think the result would have been quite different. But Quest, it was quite isolated. That very last step, that end where the computer is doing the data processing, Quest is hands off. It provided the software, but it didn't install it, it doesn't run it, it doesn't get anything back out of it.
Anything further?
Pardon? If I talk to the Section 101 claim just for a moment, Your Honor,
sure,
I would believe that in addition to the waiver, pardon?
You have a little time left.
Okay, let me use it then. This is a case where, I'd just like to back up for a moment. On the full and fair opportunity, the opportunity we had in this court, the first opportunity we had to address whether or not defendants were entitled to, in Newegg, were entitled to judgment as a matter of law, was after the panel rules on rehearing. That is not the full opportunity envisioned by the federal rules. And it is not the full opportunity that Blondertong imagined. Remember, Blondertong overruled 150 years of precedent that said you will never, ever get an all-defendant, all-time preclusion because we're going to require mutuality. But in overruling that, the Supreme Court was very careful not to require an adequate opportunity, an okay opportunity, a partial opportunity, but a full opportunity to litigate the issues. And if one thing is clear, an opportunity to litigate an issue that arises for the first time on rehearing is anything but a full opportunity. I think Avon pretty much got it right on page 8 of their reply brief, where they say, but rehearing is part of that opportunity. It is part of that opportunity, but it's only a part of that opportunity. And it's probably the least meaningful part. The most meaningful part is to have the opportunity, notice of the issues, and the opportunity to brief them before the court, before the panel has ruled. That's the opportunity we didn't get here. And for that reason, in addition to the Rule 50 issues, we believe that there should be no preclusion in this case and the judgment should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Josepher, you have 4 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I should probably start with all these waiver arguments. In terms of the new waiver argument that we waived our right to rely on the preclusive effect of Newegg, even if there was a waiver argument there, they waived it by not raising it until oral argument. Second, the reason it doesn't work, as Judge Steigart explained, is this Court's already squarely ruled against it, including in the Thompson-Hayward against Roman Haas is the first case this Court that squarely addressed it. In that case, the defense of inequitable conduct had not been raised at all in the District Court, and this Court held you can still rely on a preclusive effect here. Subsequent decisions of this Court, including Mendenhall, which you mentioned, and Dana, have made clear that certainly applies to invalidity defenses that were raised, at least in some respect, in the District Court. With respect to the waiver, and then with respect to the merits of preclusion first, and their contention that this Court gave unprecedentedly unfair treatment to them last year, one thing they did not dispute...
Well, I don't think they say unfair treatment. They say that rehearing is not the same as full merits consideration, as indeed... the rules seem to suggest it's not.
Right, and a couple important points. One thing they do not dispute, though, is that this Court does have authority to grant appropriate relief regardless of whether a litigant requested it. I mean, that's clear from the briefing, and it's true. That means that whether this Court correctly exercised that authority in the circumstances of that case is clearly a merits question that's not subject to relitigation in a different case. But second, even apart from that, as Judge Dyke pointed out, as Judge Dyke's questioning confirmed, they're not arguing they would have put anything different in the District Court record. They're just arguing about how they would have marshaled the evidence differently in this court. And Dana Corp, for example, a decision of this court, makes clear that as long as the evidence was in existence and available to them, that's the full and fair hearing. Also, though, even if there's any doubt about whether the panel decision had been wrong, it was more than remedied by the partial grant of rehearing, which allowed them to then make all the arguments and get a real consideration of those arguments.
Can you remind me, was that grant limited to... There was some confusion about Claim 34 and 35.
It was limited to one claim, but as their supplemental briefs and hearing pointed out, that claim contained all the relevant elements, and so they then re-argued all these points, albeit in the context of a different but materially comparable claim, which is why this court, in its rehearing decision, gave the passage I read earlier about how they've argued these points and we reject them on the merits, was essentially what the court said. Moving to 101, I don't have really any much at all to add to Judge Dyke's questioning concerning why you don't have to file a Rule 50B motion after Rule 50A motion has been granted. That grant finally resolves the issue, and anything beyond that would just be, you know, annoying pestering of a judge on an issue it had already resolved. And the main reason, as I recall, the main reason behind Unitherm is that denial of JMOL doesn't preserve anything because it's not a final resolution of the issue. A grant of JMOL is clearly a final resolution of the issue.
Can I ask you, you do make two very closely related but distinct arguments about obviousness. One is the issue preclusion argument, and the other is essentially the precedent-based argument that on the merits, this is obvious as a matter of law, just reading Newegg as a precedent. Put aside the first point, the issue preclusion. On the second, is that available to you for in the absence of a Rule 50? I gather you agree. You did not, in fact, make a Rule 50 under either A or B motion as to obviousness.
Well, the 50B motion, the release specifically requested was a new trial, but it was framed in terms of no reasonable jury could have determined.
Did it discuss obviousness?
Oh, yeah, on obviousness. There's no question we filed.
50B motion for a new trial?
Are you talking
well, I'm
about
sorry.
A new
our, it was a new, you're right, 50B is not a new trial. Right? Our post-trial motion on obviousness was framed in terms of new trial, but
here or a new egg? I'm talking about here.
Yeah, our 50B motion our post-trial motion in the district court in this case on obviousness, argued obviousness, not obviousness. The relief, it was captioned as a motion for a new trial, but the substance said
right,
no reasonable jury could determine.
Right, because you did not make a 50A motion for judgment of obviousness, so you really couldn't make a 50B motion for obviousness, but you could make a Rule 59 new trial motion?
I don't know.
But in any way, you did not make a Rule 50B or motion asking for judgment as a matter of law on obviousness.
We did not file a Rule 50A motion. I would agree with that. The post-trial motion is subject to
that pretty much takes care of 50B. So even if we could rule on issue preclusion without that motion, can we rule on the issue of obviousness without that?
I would say yes because, I mean, it's a question of law. And that's one of the odd things.
You could do the same thing that was done in Newbank.
Well, yeah, correct. There's very little difference between here and there. But the other thing is, I mean, the reason that this is normally viewed as a collateral estoppel issue is the understanding that they're normally factual issues. When you've got obvious now as a question of law, this court in two precedential decisions in Newegg opined as a matter of law that these patents are obvious, then we've been arguing it's collateral estoppel because the exceptions are so limited, but I think there's a very good argument that you don't even need to get there because this is a legal question. This court's resolved it in two precedential decisions. Stare decisis would control, and when something's a pure question of law like that, this court has some discretion in applying the preservation rules.
Okay. Well, I think we're out of time. Thank you, Mr. Deser. Thank both counsel. Thank all three counsel. Case is submitted. Okay,
and there are additional procedural protections as well. So for ALJ. So the agency cannot furlough ALJs and then tell them after the fact, go appeal to the board if you're upset with that. The board has original jurisdiction over adverse actions against ALJs, so the agency has to go to the board first.
So apart from the independence and the procedures, it's the those are the only additional rights that ALJs have.
Yes, I can't think of others. Now, in a particular factual circumstance...
Can you envision a situation where what might be a sound business decision for regular employees would amount to an interference with ALJ's independence.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. Particularly, perhaps if there were a case where an agency were furloughing some but not all of its ALJs, and then the board would be well within its rights to probe the reasons for that.
ALJ. And that sounds more like disparate treatment. I was thinking more along the lines of if there was such severe budget shortfalls that there was going to be extremely lengthy furloughs for all agency employees, like 6-month furloughs. Do you think that that might interfere with their independent judicial decision-making in such a way that then spreading them out evenly might not be good cause, that the board could determine that in order for them to carry out their adjudicatory functions, the furlough dollar or the sequester dollar should have been distributed differently?
And just make sure I understood the beginning of the hypothetical. It's that everyone in the agency is being furloughed, not that the ALJs are being furloughed
right.
for 6 months.
That, it's this very severe sequester. Mm-hmm. The agency decides everybody's out of work for 6 months.
I think in that kind of case, the board is likely to say, as it said here, that the furlough obviously has an impact on the efficiency with which the ALJs can perform their functions. But that's a different construct, a different idea than trying to influence the way in which they decide their cases. And that's what Congress was concerned about with respect to ALJs, that agencies, that they're agency employees, but Congress was concerned that agencies not direct or influence the way that they make their decisions. That's what they are free from. And
importantly, ALJs entitled to a greater protection against disparate treatment than other employees or not?
No, I don't think it's any greater treatment. I think the board here correctly said it's a consideration. It's an important consideration,
so
and
if there were a sequester which didn't have the specificity that this one did, that what you're saying is that labor could say, well, we think ALJs are less important than other employees, so we're going to give them a longer furlough.
The agency could say that. Now, the board would and could then examine, does that somehow influence their decisional independence? I think the fair answer is no, but that the agency might decide, well, getting these, waiting an additional 6 days for these ALJs to work on their decisions is not as important as regulating workers' rights for workers who go into mines and face death or serious injury at work. If labor makes that kind of trade-off, it's more important that we have the mine inspectors at work. That's the kind of decision, the essence of agency discretion that the board has declined to review in this case.
Can I ask you two questions? One is, it was argued before that there was an OMB directive that in fact gave the Labor Department discretion to reallocate money between separately managed PPAs, and the Labor Department violated that directive by thinking that, by saying that it's simply not going to do that, indeed thinking that it was required not to do that. Can you address that? And then I want to ask you about the discovery aspect of the case.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the OMB memo that petitioners are referring to is at page 1125 of the record. And there, in the second to last bullet point, now there was OMB said essentially the same thing in a couple of different memos, but this is one example here. Second to last bullet point, it said that agencies could take into account funding flexibilities, including the availability of reprogramming and transfer authority. So that is authorities that pre-existed the sequester, authorities that existed for moving money around, still existed after the sequester. And there was testimony in this case that, in fact, there was one reprogramming done to the Office of Administrative Law Judges to mirror a reprogramming that had taken place under the previous fiscal year's budget. It wasn't geared toward or for the purpose of anything related to furloughs. It was to carry over the budget from the previous year. Labor made a decision not to forcibly reprogram funds from one PPA to another.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking, this is what I want to understand. Is it true or not true that this is a situation, which sometimes happens, where an agency does not recognize that it has discretion, believes it is doing what it is required to do, and sometimes courts say, no, if you have discretion, you have to recognize it and face the various choices and exercise it, but you didn't do that. You thought you lacked discretion. Is that what is happening here?
No, Your Honor. The witness who testified about this issue is Jeff Kenyon, who is the director of the Budget Center, and his particular statements on this issue are in several different places in the record. But the first place is at 536, where he was asked whether any programming took place, i.e. taking money from you, meaning from other agencies, because I think ALJ is more important. And Mr. Kenyon said, no, there's no decision along those lines. He didn't say, no, we weren't permitted to do that. We didn't have any discretion to do that. His answer was, we didn't do that.
Right. What do you mean at the top of page 30 in your brief where you discuss his testimony or discuss him? He said, Kenyon testified that under the sequestration order, labor had no discretion to reduce the adjudication budget any less than 5%. Is that different from this allocation decision that we're talking about? You say that he testified that labor lacked certain discretion. Is that the discretion that they are saying?
I think that statement reflects the fact that OMB direction and the Budget and Control Act specified that the percentage reductions were to be applied at the PPA level. Now that's
not the reallocation question.
Right. I think that's a separate question. Then after you apply that non-discretionary cut at that level, then you have the secondary question of is the agency going to exercise any of these other authorities
If I can, let me ask you about the discovery. How, in the absence of discovery, are they to figure out whether there was something nefarious in the decision-making process about the ALJs? And what are the rules about that? I mean, is it that once we decide, if we decide that they're it's a perfectly reasonable thing to say we're not going to reallocate money between separately managed PPAs, that in the absence of some, threshold of evidence, discovery is not permitted? Is that the way discovery works in MSPB or what?
No, in the MSPB has its own regulations that pertain to discovery, and although not bound by the federal rules of evidence, generally follows those rules. So discovery in board cases looks very much like discovery in...
So how are they supposed to find out if there were conversations in the relevant room that says these ALJs are just shoveling money out the door, we got to do something about it?
Well, they do that through discovery, but in this case it's
important
to look at...
Did they ask for that discovery?
Pardon me?
Did they ask for such discovery here?
Well, they... For discovery... specifically into...
Well, I know they wanted to have some of the ALJs testify that the public perception would be affected by the furloughs that they received.
Yes.
Did they ask for discovery on the bad motive issue?
They asked at least one... they had one document request that they discuss in the... I believe they reference in the reply brief, and they asked for all documents related to ALJ's performance, including evaluations, criticism, or questioning of their decisions dating back to 2009. And their theory was that documents criticizing their decisions might indicate some hostility, and then
so they never asked could for, then be for they might have asked for documents that related the furloughs to dissatisfaction with ALJ performance or something like that, but they didn't ask for that.
Nothing stands out in my memory, and they certainly haven't highlighted any such request in their briefing to this court. Now, one of the primary requests that they made and that they do brief a little more thoroughly before this court is their request to put on testimony from ALJs that their decisional independence was infringed. And the trial judge properly found that the proposed testimony was speculative. The ALJs explained in their reply brief that that their witnesses were going to explain as a, quote, matter of law and logic why ALJs might feel pressured. Which, of course, it's a matter of law and logic. You don't necessarily need a witness for that. There was no ALJ who was going to say, I feel pressured in the following way. It was all quite speculative about what other ALJs may hold. And so no abuse of discretion in the trial court's judgment there. And the trial judge, who I'm calling trial judge to avoid confusion, said with respect to the written discovery, grouped categories of requests, and said fundamentally these requests are getting to revisiting the very kinds of discretionary decisions that
is what troubles me. So I want you to focus particularly on request for production number 6. This is described, I guess, at 317, A317. This request seeks all documents prepared after January 1st, 2009, regardless of source, related to the activities or performance of the OALJ, including but not limited to documents evaluating, criticizing, or questioning the actions or judicial decisions of the OALJ.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it that that can be denied? It seems at least possible that some of those documents would reflect discussions at the time of the budget decision. How is that? What's the ground for rejecting that?
There are a couple of different grounds. And if the first ground, I'll note that this page 317 This was the ALJ's motion for reconsideration. They previously moved to compel production. The trial judge initially denied their motion, saying you have not set forth specified reasons why your individual requests are valid, and you need to do that under the rules, and denied the motion to compel. So this is coming back on a motion for reconsideration. And the trial judge said first that you didn't follow the rules, it's too late. You have to follow the rules. And of course, there are numerous decisions in which ALJ's application of the MSPB's own discovery rules, this court has said, is not an abuse of discretion. But to be clear, the trial judge didn't stop there. In his order on the second discovery request, he noted that the ALJ's rationale for these requests, this is at page 321, the ALJs had introduced a new rationale for their request, and that was, as the trial judge put it, to pursue an entirely separate disparate treatment argument along the lines of an illegal discrimination claim. And the trial judge said, this is not a discrimination case. You're not a protected class. ALJs aren't a protected class in the same way that women or employees over the age of 40 or minority employees are. So that was yet another basis.
Did the ALJs argue that the decisions made by labor in connection with the sequester were motivated by a dislike of or desire to punish ALJs?
I think it's fair to say that they offered speculation on that point, that it could be for that reason. And the board, after a two-day hearing, actually ran over into a telephone witness on a third day, 7 witnesses, 150 filings, post-hearing filings, looking at all of that evidence, found that this was not to interfere with their decisional independence. This was a terrible...
The discovery question, I guess, I think that the core of their point is a finding made in the absence of discovery of possibly relevant evidence is suspect.
That is their point, but this case is very unlike, for example, the Whitmore case where an employee sought to prove motive in a discrimination claim, and it was the employee's burden, and the administrative judge denied all discovery on that. Here, we have these discovery requests that the ALJs did not adequately support when they did move for a motion to compel, so we have a procedural concern, which, by the way, there was a separate discovery ruling in Whitmore.
What does that mean, adequately support? What are they supposed to do?
The trial judge wanted an explanation of request one. The agency didn't give us what we requested. Here's why this request is reasonably calculated to lead to discoverable evidence. The ALJs...
Well, in that connection, did they articulate that this request is being made because we believe that the actions taken by labor in connection with the sequester were motivated by dislike or whatever of administrative law judges?
In the... Let me find the page that we were just looking at. To go back to the example that we were looking at previously, at page 3... 17, yes, thank you, Your Honor. They said they thought these particular documents, and again, this is after the trial judge already said you haven't given me the kind of detail I want, it's too late. So this is their second chance. There's at least a reasonable possibility that
where are we on
this? This is at under request for production 6, 317, okay. At page 317. That there are documents that would show criticisms or questions about their actions, including discriminatory statements.
Finish that. It's the clause that comes after that.
Discriminatory statements or expressions.
Specifically, is at issue.
Or expressions by department officials of negative attitudes toward such employees.
Right. So a response from the trial judge that says you're not a protected class, it's not that kind of discrimination, goes only to the first point. I'm not sure it goes to the second point. Right, they are saying, we want to try to prove that the decision makers had an anti-ALJ motive of the sort that would actually be in the category of forbidden bases for furloughs.
Well, on that point, I think the trial judge's statement about this not being a discrimination case is relevant. Because the critical inquiry here is this action going to infringe on decisional independence? It's not precisely the same kind of exploration of subjective motivations of agency employees that you see in a discrimination case. Now, I also should mention that in the decision denying the discovery request, this is at page 325 of the record, the administrative judge also said that the additional request of discovery at that point in the case would delay the proceedings, which needed to be expedited, and that the judge would revisit this issue if the hearing showed that there was a suggestion of interference here, and the ALJs had an opportunity to cross-examine four different agency witnesses, and there was nothing to suggest such interference here. And in fact, to the contrary, a holding that there wasn't. Now, so we believe the court should hold there was no...
I think we're out of time, Ms. Cannella. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. May.
Your Honor, I would like to first address the...
Let me ask you about this last point that we've been talking about. Was there... I understand that you tried to get generalized inquiry into whether Labor Department officials had written documents expressing dissatisfaction with ALJs, but did you allege that the particular decisions made in connection with the sequester were the result of hostility to ALJs?
We didn't specifically allege that because, frankly, we didn't know. That's the purpose of the discovery, was to find out if there was some evidence of that to support such an allegation, if there was evidence.
Where did you say you wanted discovery to connect hostility toward ALJs to the decisions made in the sequester?
Well, in our first submission of reasons for the request, which was, it's on page 288, 289, we talk about production request number 6. We seek information pertaining to possible intimidation or retaliation against ALJs because of their exercise of independent judgment in the course of their duties. And then we say the relevance of this information is so obvious that it requires no explanation. Because by that point, the trial judge...
Okay, so that kind of falls short of a suggestion that the sequester decisions were motivated by hostility.
Well, I think it's implicit in there, but we also had a second explanation. And that's on page Joint Appendix 317. These documents are discoverable because there is at least a reasonable possibility that internal Labor Department documents contain evaluations, criticisms, and of judicial decisions, will include discriminatory statements about ALJs or expressions that the department feels has negative attitudes.
So what? I mean, there may have been over the years criticism of ALJs about particular decisions, but how does that help to show that the sequester decisions were connected to that?
Well, we say towards the end of this paragraph on 317, in short, such evidence is highly relevant to the issues in this case, and access to these kinds of documents is essential if the respondents are to have a fair opportunity to show that purported reasons for the disproportionate furloughs are a pretext.
But did you specifically ask for any documents relating to decision makers identifying a reason for imposing furloughs on ALJs, a dislike of ALJs? I mean,
well,
you're suggesting that if we go out and find in the past there's evidence of dislike of ALJs, then that is a basis for the sequester. But you didn't ask for the sequester decision documents that might show that ALJs were disliked. Those other documents don't seem all that relevant. Unless there's an actual document.
No, I submit that they are relevant depending on their timing. If there's a document from 4 or 5 years prior, it's probably not relevant. But if there's a document for 2 or 3 days or even 2 or 3 weeks around the time that acting director refused...
But unless that document says it's in connection with the sequester, it could just be they don't like ALJs in general, not that they're furloughing ALJs because they don't like them.
Well, it could be. I mean, it's circumstantial evidence, and they could make that argument that it's not related to the sequester, but I think we wanted the evidence because it would support a circumstantial evidence that there was a connection.
Yeah, but I think the suggestion is that the request was overly broad. It asked for all documents in this category from 2009 on, and it seems very difficult to argue that kind of broad request is appropriate.
Well, I think it might have been appropriate for the presiding trial judge to say, this request is too broad, they say it's too burdensome, we'll reduce it to certain things.
Well, it's kind of up to you, isn't it?
Pardon?
It's up to you, isn't it, to craft a request that's appropriate?
Yes, it is, and I certainly tried to keep this as narrow as possible. But
how is the document from 2009 that might say, we dislike ALJs relevant to sequester decisions?
Well, frankly, if I found such a document, I wouldn't have tried to use it.
What we were really hoping to get
were more current documents.
But that's not what you asked for.
No, this was a little broad. I'll admit that. It was a little broad.
So,
but it wasn't.
Given that it's an abuse of discretion standard, how could we possibly say, and it was abuse of discretion to deny it, since you conceded it was broad?
It was an abuse of discretion to deny it entirely. Proper use of discretion would have said, this is too broad, cut it down to 1 year or 6 months surrounding this sequester decision.
Okay. Once you go ahead, we're out of time, but we'll give you another minute or so to address whatever else
Thank
you
want
to address.
But I do want to address that issue that our motion to compel and our motion for reconsideration were inadequate in terms of itemizing our reasons. I would urge the court, if the members of the court only look at one document in the appendix, to look at the one at page 288 to 290. That's our statement showing the information sought by the respondents is discoverable. And in there, we lay out the reasons. We combine some of the interrogatories and other discovery requests that seek information for the same reason together. And so we don't list all 47 requests and go down one, this is the reason, and use our cut and paste tools on our computers to paste in the same answer that we gave to nine other requests. We combine them all in a shorter document. And frankly, I think that complies with the rules. And it's not a material deviation from the rules that the judge just was, for a while, I wondered if he even got the document. I thought he had been lost in transmission or something, because we did lay out the reasons for those requests.
Okay, I think, Mr. Mavis, we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank both counsel, and the case is submitted.
Thank you.